Welcome, everybody. Welcome to the Legendarium podcast. I am your host, Craig Hanks, reminding you to go to thelegendarium.com, where you can find the calendar for upcoming episodes. You can find past episodes grouped by author, by series, and you can also find all of these author's shelf episodes in one place if you care to do that. So thelegendarium.com. You can also get the link to Discord, where you can join the conversation, and the link to Patreon if you care to support the show, which we greatly appreciate, of course. Now, I already let the cat out of the bag. This is an author's shelf episode. We're talking Jade City by Fonda Lee, and I am joined by Moses Ozeotomi. If I got that right, I think so. Moses, how are you?
Nailed it. I'm good, man. I'm excited for this. This is going to be a lot of fun.
Good. You know, these are really fun for me. Obviously, I've done dozens of them now, so they must be pretty fun. But I do get feedback, more often than not from authors going, oh, yeah, that was a lot of fun. Because the whole point of this was authors tend to answer the same questions over and over and over again about their books, right? So if you ever do a media tour or, you know, whatever, you're answering a lot of the same questions. And this is just, like I say every once in a while, this is a great way for listeners to get to know authors in a different way. So what we do is, for those unfamiliar with the author shelf, I ask an author to pull something off of their shelf, not something they've written. Okay, so we are going to talk about The Truth of the Aleke at the end of the episode. This is Moses's upcoming book, so we will dive into that. You're going to hear about stuff that's coming up, but instead of diving into your book, we're diving into something that you find important, inspirational, really cool, you know, whatever the parameters are. My only parameters are, let's talk about a book that's important to you for any reason. And you chose Jade City by Fonda Lee. Mm-hmm. Why did you choose this book, Moses?
So many reasons. The most important one, I think. So, I grew up reading fantasy. That was all I read. I took a break from fantasy for a while. I went to grad school. I got an MFA, and you know, it wasn't the most like fantasy hospitable program. So I kind of had to take a break and read. Yeah, very surprising. I was just reading a bunch of like literary stuff and memoir and all these other things, which were good for me as a writer, but I had to like at some point dive back into it. I'm like, eventually I realized that's what I love. That's what I want to write. That's who I am. And so Jade City was one of the first new fantasy series I like fully dived back into when I kind of come back to the fantasy world. Mm-hmm. I picked up some other books, and because I was so like trapped in the mind of like literary fiction, I was just couldn't quite get back into fantasy mode, and it was weird. And eventually I picked up Jade City and I read it, and I was like, this is scratching that itch. Whatever itch I have where like I need a fantasy, but it needs to satisfy some of the other aspects, it was doing it. And I was like, this is amazing. I loved all three books. If you haven't read any of them, read them now. If you have read the first two or any of them, keep reading, because it only gets better and better. And so when you mentioned this, I was like, what's a great, you know, there's a lot of value in highlighting like classics, but I was like, I don't know. They're dead. They don't need the royalties. I was like, what's a book that people need to hear more about? And I feel like a lot of people, even fantasy fans, haven't necessarily read this book. So I figured it'd be a great conversation.
No, it's perfect. This is one of the reasons I love keeping the prompt so open-ended, you know, pick anything off of your shelf that's important to you, is that we do get some surprising stuff I've never heard of, stuff that, you know, maybe it's like an 80s classic fantasy, or, you know, Brent Weeks says, let's read the Odyssey. It's like, okay, right. Sure, Brent. So sometimes we get stuff like that. And then sometimes it's something like Jade City, which does come up a lot, like on our Discord server, where people are saying, oh yeah, you got to read this. And so I've been hearing about it for a few years, and then somebody comes along and says, no, we're doing it. And it's perfect, because it kind of gets me off my butt, and it gets me reading this new classic in a way.
Right.
So, all right, I want to pick up on something you said. You'd been doing a lot of the literary side of things, and longtime listeners know it's a massive pet peeve of mine that we differentiate between literary fiction and genre fiction or whatever, just because, you know, my whole thing is, look, if it's good, it's good.
Right.
It's all literature. But I get that there is some kind of distinction. So in your mind, when you say, okay, I was doing a lot of the literary stuff, and then this was kind of scratching that itch that I had, are you able to identify what those aspects of literature are that you weren't getting from, you know, other unnamed fantasy books and series that Jade City was able to do?
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't know 100%. I think, though, when I think about the, I agree, often artificial distinction between literary and genre, one thing I do think is somewhat true more of the spaces than of the works is that the literary space is very rewarding of novelty, of things that do something new in terms of the writing, whether it's a new type of voice or a new structure. And I think the genre space is very rewarding of imagination, I think especially the fantasy space. I read a ton of books with dragons, and I think we all love dragons. I don't think anybody's like, oh no, another dragon. I mean, we just like dragons, and we like to see, you know, how imaginative you can make it, but we don't necessarily, I don't think the space demands new things in the same way, right? Right. Especially, I think, when it comes to like writing mechanics or structure, I don't think the space is really, really demanding that you stop using quotes and figure out some other way to deliver, you know, speech, you know, stuff like that. So,
there aren't a lot of Cormac McCarthy style fantasy writers or whatever.
Right. Yeah. I don't think they would get too far, to be honest, commercially. But I do think Jade City then maybe felt fresh enough. I think it's a very inventive book in a lot of ways. Mm. And so maybe that was the itch where I felt like this feels different enough in terms of setting, in terms of the themes, which I think we'll talk about quite a bit, in terms of the characters. You know, it did, you know, obviously it's not like a D&D sword and sorcery, you know, European inspired fantasy. But I think even beyond that, I think it felt very fresh and new in a way that I was like, oh yeah, I'm ready to invest in this world.
Yeah. It's, that's so interesting that you say that about novelty being rewarded elsewhere. I think you are directionally correct, but it is interesting what a splash somebody like N.K. Jemisin can make.
Right.
What, you know, right where she comes along and she says, I'm going to do something, I'm going to structure it this different way and then also give you these different tenses and voices to throw you off and build this, this narrative. And it just sent shockwaves through genre fiction. But is that just the exception that proves the rule, right? You know, most of the time it is kind of I don't know if I say most of the time.
Yeah, maybe I made it sound like a two separate circles. There's a heavy Venn diagram, right? And so I think, you know, of course the literary space rewards imagination, and I think of course the genre space rewards novelty. Yeah. But I will maintain. No, I'll probably change my mind. But like, I think for now, that's at least how I think about it. You know, like in terms of when I think of why is a literary book getting a ton of acclaim or selling very well versus why it's
right. Like I say, I think you're directionally right. And if we zoom out, like I can kind of think of the last 10 or 15 years where things maybe are a little different. If you zoom out for a generation or two, it's like, nah, you've got the farm boy, you've got the Luke Skywalker going out, and that's your thing, right?
Yeah.
Anyway, so all right, let's talk Jade City then, and actually get into this book. It's I didn't prepare any sort of synopsis, but for those who maybe it's been a little while or you haven't read it, it's a book that takes place in a country that's loosely based on, as I understand it, post-war Hong Kong. So after World War II, and it's a generation after that, something like that.
Ish.
And so it's this people with the magical powers that's tied to Jade, the stone. And so there's a combination of genetic predisposition to this and then training that helps you to master these skills that you're able to pull from Jade. Anyway, all right. Now I find the setting extremely interesting because you know what? No, we're going to come back to the setting. No, we're not. No, we're going to do the setting now. I was going to ask you about themes, but I think maybe we talk about setting first. Because it's an aspect of world history that I think, understandably, this isn't, I don't see this as like a massive indictment or something, but Americans especially don't know much about what happened to China in World War II. And it is not a nice story.
Wild.
It is.
Yeah.
China got screwed. And so we think of the post-war period in the late 40s and in the 50s as this kind of like Stepford Wives, suburban, bountiful peacetime, right? Where everything is going well, right? Because America didn't get bombed into oblivion like a lot of the rest of the world. China, China got screwed. Anyway, so that's where we're at. Any other historical context that you can think of that's kind of important for understanding this kind of tribal warfare that's going on in this society?
I mean, I'm not, you know, that's, I'm not a historian of this at all. I lived in China briefly. So some of the setting felt familiar in that way, but I think Lee is good about, it's a blend of Asian cultures. I know it's not specifically Hong Kong. I know like Hong Kong gangster flicks and Hong Kong cinema played a big role in the inspiration.
Right.
I know like there's wushu elements and it's a, in the same way that I think we don't always highlight, but in most like kind of European inspired fantasies, they're like European inspired, right? It's not like this is a French fantasy or this is a, you know, Bavarian fantasy. It's, you know, you're taking
kind generalized.
Of, right. It's like a combination of the historical research and of like the popular mythos, right? Like when people think of European medieval times, it's like there's a general culture of that in itself, of how we think about it. And then you take some research and then you blend it. I think Lee did a great job of doing that with kind of Chinese and Hong Kong and Japan and Korea and a lot of different aspects of kind of East Asia.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, even the name of Kekkon and Kikon, the Kekkonese sounds a lot like the Cantonese, right?
So yeah,
there are echoes, but it's, as you say, it's definitely not like a one-to-one correlation. Mm-hmm. But still, it's something to consider. And it is the kind of, there is some, how should I put this? I love books that send me on a quest for real world knowledge. And this would be a great example of that, where I kind of, I have a broad brush understanding that, like, you know, in America, we think of the Pacific theater in World War II, and we're like, yeah, us versus the Japanese in the Pacific Ocean. It's like, yeah, no, the vast bulk of Japanese forces were spent terrorizing the Chinese mainland, right?
Yeah.
Where this book kind of gives you a sketch of what life might have been like with this busted down society that then is kind of reemerging, and there are these criminal gangs, these rival gangs that take over cities, and you know, it's kind of chaos for a while until it's not, right? Anyway, and a book like this gives me that flavor and sends me on that quest to learn more about what actually happened in real world history, and I just love stuff like that.
That really makes sense, and it is a really cool feeling when you're being, like, the book can, like, guide you, like, to the doorstep of another aspect of society or of the world that you haven't encountered before. And then you get to, like, really dive in. And, yeah, even, like, the mix of – I did a lot of – not a ton of research, but I remember each time they would mention, like, a car name, I would Google, like, is that a real car? Or, like, you know, like, if so, what does it look like? And, like, what is it, like, a comparison to cars from that era, from the era? You know, even the book, kind of the tech of the book spans eras, too. You know, like, there's, like, payphones, but then there's also, like, cars, and there's guns. And I know, like, if I were a historian, I'd be like, maybe all these things didn't exist in this form at the same time, but, like, you know, I'm trying to tell a story.
But they were all around at some point.
Right. Yeah. And it's also cool. I mean, cool things are important when you're writing a book. So do what's cool.
you just made me think that this is a whole other episode. Okay. So we're not going to chase this, but there's got to be an episode discussion about how having Google has affected the way we read books and like what kind of things the author can trust us as readers to figure out.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, 45 years ago, it's like, you know, they're not going to know.
They're going to go to the library,
just Google it,
search the stacks, find a book related to the topic, flip through it, ask the librarian. Yeah. That'd be a lot of work too.
All right. So let's talk about the themes of this book then. What do you see? Is there a primary theme? Is there a group of them? What do you take out of this book?
I think this is an exciting thing for me, because I think this book is one of the better examples of how to execute theme. And I think theme is often best executed through character. And so there's this idea of like a character web that I did not invent. I don't know who invented it, but I steal it a lot and I pretend it's mine. This idea that like every character should be a commentary on the theme or on some central meaning of the story. And what the result you get then is that every character now has inherent conflicts with each other, right? It's a way to generate conflict very organically, because I think I would argue that in Jade City, for example, one of the central themes is like family is everything. Family is maybe at the core right. of life, right? And now you have the trio, Hilo, Lan, and Shay. And I would argue they each kind of are a different argument on that theme, right? All of them kind of hold that family is at the core of life. But Hilo kind of has like family is at the core of life, and so you have to defend it violently and relentlessly, right? Right? Mm. Shay has like family's at the core of life, and it's kind of this like unfortunate but real thing, right? Like family is kind of always tugging at you, but it's not always desirable. And it's best to, in some ways, argue, I think her character is like, keep your space and keep your own peace independent from family. And then you have Lan, who's like, family's at the core of life. And it's kind of this enormous burden to always be there for them and to always show up for them. And so I think you see that, and this is, of course, my interpretation, but you see that manifested in their characters from the way they're introduced. I mean, Hilo is introduced right in a fight scene, which makes sense for his character. Mm-hmm. Shay is introduced returning to Kekkon and is kind of like, ugh. And she picks up the payphone, is going to call for a car, and she's like, I don't want it. I'm not part of them in the same way anymore. I don't want to be depending on them. And then Lan, the first line I think of Lan is like Lan couldn't sleep or something like that. Like he just stays up all night. Like he's always thinking about how to be the best pillar and how to take care of everybody and how to, you know, get ahead of his enemies. And family is this intense burden for him. And if you've read the book, you know what that results in. But I think that's an incredible way to turn theme instead of just like the theme is like preaching at you. I think some books do that. And I think you can get away with it where the theme is like being, you know, beat over your head. Like family's everything. Family's important. Family's everything. Family's important.
I've seen the Fast and Furious movies. I know.
Right. Yes. That's a great promo. If you like Fast and Furious, check out Jade City.
Yeah. There you go.
Yeah. I think like instead of beating you over the head with it, it's making an argument, right? It's letting you see different aspects of the argument of is family everything? Is that good? Is that bad? What are the negatives of that? What is the result of that? How can that bolster you? How can that weaken you? And it becomes, I think, very fascinating.
I know. I love that. Okay. I hadn't thought of it in those terms. I have this, when I think of this book, I think a lot in terms of like modernity versus pre-modernity, right? Yeah. Where you have Shay would be a great example, and Lan to a certain extent, of characters who recognize that if family is the only thing that matters, nothing will ever change. There will always be this tribal warfare with families warring against each other.
Yeah.
And they're sick of it, you know, and they well, you know, especially Shay, I would say.
Right.
They want things to change. And Shay is a great example of, like you say, kind of getting sucked back into it. But anyway, so that's where my mind went as I was reading the book. But I don't think these are exclusive themes. That it does kind of tie together. One of the ideas behind modern societies is the idea of breaking down or softening some of those bonds so that you can bond with others outside of your core group and arrive at peaceful solutions or, you know, trade or whatever the thing may be that gets you past the Hilo violent means to get to violent ends, right?
Yeah, yeah, and Hilo is—he's like a delicious character, just because that sort of like hothead is extremely wish fulfilling and fun. Like I think most people who read books are typically pretty like law-abiding, reasonable people, and so you get to like live out your renegade fantasies through people like
Hilo. You go watch John Wick,
right? Yeah,
drive home 100 miles an hour. Yeah, such a badass.
Yeah, and Hilo definitely—that's who he is. But I think you're right. Like his propensity for violence is tested, right? I mean, in the first book, we can discuss spoilers. The whole point is this is spoilers, right?
Yes, yes. Okay. Spoilers abound. You've been warned. Here we go.
I mean, the first book, to have him go from horn to pillar is just a great, I mean, you know, you test characters by pushing them out of their comfort zone. That's a great example. It's like, he's like, I'm the horn, my job is violence. And they're like, well, now you're the pillar and your job is way more complicated than that. He's like, but I like violence, you know, but I want to hit things. That seems to solve problems. And he has to learn that, you know, that's kind of, as you were saying, that your sense of family needs to change and grow and to complicate, right? It's not as simple as like, I like my brother and sister and my friends. It's like, well, right, what about
exactly
other people? And what about the family of the country, as we see later in the series? Like, is that a family in the world and there's bigger things, you know?
Now, do we get into the horn, the pillar, and what's the third
Weatherman.
Weatherman. Okay.
Yeah.
The other two are so phallic that I kept getting distracted through the whole book, but that's neither here nor there. just a point of fun, I suppose. Did you have a favorite character to read? You know, is it the rip roaring kind of swashbuckling Hilo? Do you like the kind of more cerebral Shay stuff? Where do you get drawn?
Hilo's definitely an easy favorite, but I think Lan. I like overburdened characters. I'm a big Wheel of Time fan.
Oh, now we're talking. Right. Oh, boy.
And Randall Thor is my guy. And I think part of that is just like seeing him just acquire more and more burdens. Like, I remember at the beginning, he has like Luz in his head, or at some point. And then he gets like the water bonds, and now he has other people in his head. And it's like, by the end of the series, he has like ten different voices all in his head. And it's such a great representation of like how much of a burden leadership can be and how much it's weighing him down. And that scene in Memory of Light when he finally like reunites with Tam and hugs him and he's just like breaking down and crying. It's like, yeah, there's, you know, the weight of duty and the way, you know, Lan talks about it all the time. Lan in the Wheel of Time talks about it. Lan in the Greenbone Saga lives it of like duty is, it's a mountain. It's heavier than a mountain. And I think Lan's character in the Greenbone Saga is my favorite to read for that reason. But Hilo's a ton of fun. And I like Shay. Shay grows on me, especially throughout the like initial introduction of like, I'm a very family oriented person. So her introduction of like, I'm too cool for these people. I kind of got it, but I was also kind of annoyed by it. But she grows. She grows really well.
Yeah. Now, what about you? Shay, for me, I, as you say, they all have their fun, their good aspects to read. There's something I've noticed about myself in the last decade that I seem to be drawn to the female characters for whatever reason. You know, I'm thinking now, I know there are more examples, but I'm thinking of the Stormlight Archive, where I just want the Shallan chapters. That's all I want. And so with Shay, it's something about her, as you say, the reticence, that is a good driver for me. That's compelling for me. Like, I don't really want to be here, but I'm getting sucked in just when I thought I was out.
Right,
they pulled me back in. I love that stuff. And then when she gets assigned to audit the books. And what's going on with all this jade that's being harvested, for lack of a better word, that's being trafficked, and she discovers that there's missing jade, and so there's some black market trade going on, and it's her. Nobody tricks her into it, but it's her own drive that gets her back into the family and back into the politics of it. Where it was almost unavoidable as soon as she touched it and it got interesting. She's like, oh, I can't go anywhere now. I'm in, you know?
Yeah.
I really liked her.
That's such a good point. Cause like they tried to kind of trick her into it. Like they did try to kind of, maybe not muscle her back into the family, but kind of like lure her back into the family. Mm-hmm, but she's so like in a cool way, she's so independent, so defiant, so stubborn that like she could only have ever gotten back into it through her own will. Like nobody was ever going to bully her back into the family. I feel like it had to be her own idea, and you know, she reached that point at some point.
Yeah. Let me ask you about genre, because and again, longtime listeners know that I don't like to get too much into subgenre. I think subgenrefication can get tiresome, and it's not super worthwhile. However, you start reading this book, and I'm just going to posit something, and then I'll have you react to it. Because, again, we're getting into full spoilers here. If you haven't read the book and you care, heads up for the next 30 to 60 seconds. I get halfway through the book, and I've been following, especially Lan. You get and Shay, you get some Hilo, but a lot of the Hilo stuff is like people observing him and trying to wrangle him unsuccessfully. And then halfway through the book or whatever it was, Lan dies. And Lan gets killed in a duel. And right. Hilo becomes the pillar. And it was at that moment when I realized I'm not reading an epic fantasy. I'm not reading the type of story that I'm used to. So is this epic fantasy or did it just cross into soap opera? And I do not use that term as a negative, right? I think soap opera is a delightful genre. But does this get into soap opera? And the way I think of it often is if you're reading, we can stick with the Stormlight Archive. If you read the first Stormlight Archive book, you're like, okay, I've got three main characters. And by the time you're, you know, three, four books into the series, like, I've got so many freaking main characters. There is no main character. We're in soap opera territory now.
Yeah.
Game of Thrones was the other one I was thinking of, where you have to let go of the idea of a main character to make it through the story. How fair is that, do you think? What kind of book am I reading here?
I don't think it's wrong. I two things. First, when you would ask why I chose it, perhaps maybe the question of like why I love the book, I think that's why. I love stories that at some point I realized this is not the story I thought it was going to be. That's my favorite kind of story. Yeah. And this book does it well. Once Lan dies, that scene, I was like, no. I remember reading an essay, I don't know if it was, I doubt it was by George R. R. Martin. Maybe he reposted it, or maybe it referenced him heavily. But like kind of talking about the history of the genre, and I'm not a scholar of the genre, but it was discussing how like it originated as like romantic fantasy, right? And so you have this like the idea of the romance not used necessarily in terms of like love and relationships, but right, in terms of the idea of romantic and how
capital
like
R
soaring
romantic.
Sweeping right emotional passionate stories, and I think like that is maybe for me, it's become a better way to think about the genre, and it helps me understand stories like Game of Thrones and Jade City and Stormlight Archive better, where, it's the model of the, like, you know, peasant who becomes the king, an important aspect of the genre. But I do think, you know, drama is kind of at the heart of story in a way, in like having, which I think is what soap operas do extremely well, more than maybe anything. It's just drama. Like, it's real sacrifice character and consistency, you know, for drama when you think of like the televised telenovelas and stuff. And so, I don't think you're wrong to characterize that way. I wish soap opera didn't have like the connotations people, you know, attached to it, but I don't think it's wrong to be like, some of the best storytelling is extremely drama focused, extremely dramatic, in a way that's, you know, there's like sloppy, uncompelling drama. Then there's like real human drama, the drama of life, the drama of trying to be a person in the world. And I think that's where some of these other fantasy stories you've mentioned get at. And I'd agree, Jade City fits that well.
Well, something else that it does that's a little bit different than others in the genre is how it deals with magic. How Fonda Lee writes the magic system. And I'm curious how you think about it, because as I was reading it, and I tried very hard not to go and read any secondary sources or reviews or anything before I read the book. And so, I'm trying to make my thoughts my own, usually unsuccessfully, but whatever. There's the trope of either the special class of people who are born with the ability to use magic. Okay, so that's one. And then the other trope might be the school of magic. You have to Harry Potter would be like a combination. And this is something of a combination where if you're a native, if you're aboriginal in this land, then you have, like, you're not able to access the magic. And if you're a foreigner, then you're not able to access the magic. But if you have some intermingling and you're part of these clans, then you can get it. Oh, but there's also this drug that helps you to access it or enhance your powers. Oh, but there's also this. How do you feel about how she did kind of messing with and tinkering with these tropes of accessing magic?
I think this is another thing that now that I'm thinking about it, like when you said what made this book feel fresh for me, I think part of it was that I think Yeah, the Magic, it's like, it's, you know, it sits somewhere in the middle of hard and soft as well. When you think of like hard Magic systems where every rule is described and explained, and then soft Magic systems where like you turn on a light switch and butterflies fly out. Who knows how this thing works, you know? Like this almost, you know, she treats it as a resource, right? The idea is that this is a resource that you can harvest. And again, like some people are sensitive to it, some people aren't. And it's such a great device for this story of like political warfare and tribal bonds, family bonds, which are genetic, right? I mean, it's a perfect metaphor for the story of like what this magic does and how it operates. I think the idea, I wrote an essay actually that included this for Fantasy Magazine about magic as a resource and like what that can mean. I think especially if you're telling a story about society in any way or power, I think it's a really smart tool because now you have a situation where people have to suffer for the magic. There's an underclass created by the magic. There's an upper class created by the magic. And in this book, it's not as simple as like, yeah, like you said, like some people are born into it, some people aren't. It's a little more complicated than that. But if you want to talk about society, a magic that's a resource kind of inherently builds a society around it, right? It's a valuable thing. Therefore, people are going to acquire it. Therefore, some people won't have access to it. And now what does our world look like? I think it's brilliant. It's one of my favorite aspects of the book, the fact that you have to literally dig up the magic from the ground. The people doing the digging aren't the people doing the magicking.
Absolutely. Oh, so. Yeah. No, you're so right. If we talk about what sucked us into the story beyond the characters, because mm-hmm. like you say, it's all about the drama between the characters, but it's set against the backdrop of real issues that are worth thinking about and worth knowing right. about when you talk about trade, when you talk about politics, when you talk about not just trade within the city and the control of the resource within the city,
right.
but worldwide as well, right? Mm-hmm. Shea was studying in, I want to say, Spain or Portugal or something like that.
The right? equivalent in their world, yeah.
Yeah, whatever it is. Yeah. But there are aspects of the outside world where, yeah, it matters that we have this resource. And what does that mean politically, geopolitically for mm-hmm. For us and our city beyond just our clans? That stuff, oh man, it really super lights cool. my fire.
Yeah. And that's what, you know, we're not going to go into the sequel. This is about Jade City. But for those who haven't read the sequel really does get into like the international impact mm-hmm. of all these things. It's definitely worth the read. It becomes really cool.
Yeah. All right. I haven't gone on to the second one yet. So I'm looking forward to it. It should be a good time. When I do, maybe I'll
give you a call.
We'll
talk about okay. it.
All right. Any other aspects of the book that you feel like we've given short shrift to that you want to make sure that we hit?
The character of Barrow. I'm not giving that much.
Okay.
But like, he sucks, but he's great. Like,
great character, not a great dinner companion.
Yeah. Like, as a reader, I'm like, die. Like, I need him gone, especially because he was involved in the death of my boy Lan. But, like, as a writer, you know, yeah, it's such a great character to have this, like, what is essentially a human. I don't mean this in, like, a weird pejorative way. But, like, he's like a human cockroach. Like, he's endlessly survivable. Like, if a nuke went off in Kekkon, Barrow would crawl out and have some superpower, probably. And, like, but he's against our protagonist. So it's just so annoying. I mean, he's not even powerful. He's just persistent and around all the time. He opens the book, which I think is a really bold choice to have what is essentially a side character who you won't revisit often, but at the same time is also kind of at like this the thematic heart of the series of like, this is a person who grew up with nothing, right? It was not privileged. It was not wealthy. And we're going to open the story there. And then you're going to spend the rest of the story, you know, following some pretty privileged, wealthy, powerful people. And that doesn't mean they're less human or anything, but like you're seeing how their decisions impact and create people like the guy you hate. You still hate him. He still sucks. But you're like, I get it. You know, there's a lot of people in this world doing things that make people like him. And so the choice to open on him, I thought, when I first read it, I was like, what are we doing? And I got to Hilo. I was like, this is cool. This guy kicks ass. And we got to Lan. I was like, yeah, the Shea came. I was like, yeah, but in hindsight, as a writer, I'm like, that's a very bold and smart decision to open up.
I thoroughly enjoy when an author can mess with my perception of the characters. So Drew McCaffrey from Inking Out Loud, he and I are doing Matthew Stover's Acts of Cain series. And Stover does an amazing job of getting you, you know, 3-4 books into the series before he pulls the rug out and says, you've been reading Darth Vader's story the whole time, right? It's like the hero is no hero. It like goes way beyond anti-heroes and all that. Or, you know, Breaking Bad would be a great example of that, where you're kind of tricked into cheering for the wrong guy. Right. This isn't quite that, but there's some aspect of it where you're reading Barrow and thinking to yourself, you know, if he were doing this for the clan that I'm reading, the No Peak clan, if he were doing it for them, we'd be like, yeah, go Barrow. You're a real bootstraps kind of guy, aren't you? So it kind of forces you to think, okay, if he's a bad guy, why is he a bad guy? Or is he simply an antagonist?
Right. Which is great when the villain and antagonist are decoupled. I love that. And because I think there's a presumption, especially, you know, we grew up listening to stories, that's almost always the same person in most of the stories we consume. And then we become adults. And like, yeah, I think in our adult life, we see it's not always the same person. Just because someone disagrees with us doesn't mean they're like the villain of our lives. You know, that person is often the person who is kind of on our side in some ways. So Barrow is a, you know, he's not alone. It's not the first book to do it, but he's one of those characters that really does present that conundrum for the reader and be like, ugh, should I really hate this guy? And the answer is yes, to be clear. I'm not, everyone should hate Barrow. I detest him. He's the worst. You know, but there's some value in his character.
Yeah, no, that's it's all about perspective, right? Okay, so now we should talk about your books. And here's what I'm going to do. First of all, before we end, I'll say I enjoyed Jade City, and I'm so glad you picked it. So everybody go pick it up if you haven't yet. I know a lot of people on our Discord have already been bugging me about this for years, so I know you've read it. But if you haven't read it, go check it out and tell your friends, buy them a copy, et cetera, et cetera. Now, one of the aspects of the author's shelf is I'm curious. This isn't always the case, but I'm curious if this book informed your writing in any way. So people can go, I'll have a link in the description. You can go to Moses's website and check out, there's Daughters of Oduma.
Oduma.
Sorry, I will get it. And then Lies of the Ajungo. And then your forthcoming book, which should be out, you said March 5th, I think.
Correct. The sequel to Lies of the Ajungo. It's called The Truth of the Aleke.
The Truth of the Aleke. So that'll all be linked. You can check all of that out in the description. So do you think any aspect of Jade City or the Greenbone Saga as a whole made it into your writing in any way? Has this affected you?
Great question. Almost certainly. I think everything I read is operating on some level, right? But I do think part of the reason I love Jade City is that it was already dealing with things I'm already interested in. These are the themes of family and power. These are things I'm inherently always writing about. So I think it resonated in that way. Daughters of Oduma is heavily about family and trusting family and building family bonds. It's about, takes place on an island where there's no adults. It's a little fantasy island inspired by West African culture. And these kids live in essentially little tribes. And it focuses on this tribe of girls who compete in like this magical divine martial arts tournament where it's like this form of wrestling, but there's magic and gods are involved. And so, you know, the idea kind of I mentioned before with the character web and how each character is a commentary on the theme or on some central aspect of the book, that was very much at play in that book. I could not have written the book without that idea. And so you'll see some of the family drama reflected in Daughters of Oduma that you see in Jade City for sure.
Okay.
And then Lies of the Ajungo and Truth of the Aleke, that world is called the Forever Desert Trilogy. It's a very different world. It's a lot more graphic, a lot more violent. I think, and this shows up in the essay I wrote with fantasy, but the idea of magic as a resource. All magic systems, I love them all. But I am drawn to magic systems which recognize that typically magic, which is almost always a source of power, there's not a ton of series that use magic as like a weakening source or something, or avoidable source. It's a source of power. It should come at a cost, right? And I think the magic of like, the old days of like D&D, it's like the cost is like, you know, pig's ear and like, you know, leaves from the right tree. There's the idea of magic is like the kind of cauldron magic that you need ingredients for. Then there's like the magic you use energy for. It just comes from your own body's energy or whatever, your spirit energy. But I like the idea of magic is like a, like the social cost. Like who has to suffer? Who has to work? Who has to lose something for this magic to operate in the world? I think JC does a great job of that. In my world, the magic is very similar. It's a resource. Some people keep it. They prevent others from using it. And the people who don't have it, their lives are more difficult for that fact, and they have to figure out how to get access to it. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Do you feel like that's an elevator pitch for Lies of the Ajungo, or is there more to your elevator pitch for people to go check it out?
I'll give the elevator pitch. I've been practicing. Okay. I'm bad at this, but I'm trying. So for Lies of the Ajungo, it takes place in a world with multi-generational droughts. So sometimes they'll go hundreds of years without rainfall. They are in the midst of such a thing, and they have been for quite a few centuries now. And at some point in the past, it takes place in a city called the City of Lies. And at some point in the past, the king of this city essentially went to another empire who he knew had a ton of water. And he said, hey, let's work out some sort of deal. What can we give you in exchange for water? The king of that city said, the tongues of all your citizens. And he said, what now? And they repeated themselves. And so they had no choice. They needed water. And so the deal became every citizen who's 13 years or older, cut out their tongues, send it off to this empire in exchange for water. This other empire called the Ajungo are scumbags. So they only give them just enough water to keep this deal going. So every time anyone turns 13 for hundreds of years, they cut out their tongues, send it off. They get water in exchange. And that's been the status quo. But just barely enough water to survive. And the story picks up. The second component of that is that after this deal happened, the City of Lies went out and tried to find people to be like, hey, look what happened to us. Like, these people are scumbags. Let's do something about it. However, after the Ajungo took their tongues, they renamed it to the City of Lies. That's where they got their name. So now they go out and they try to ask for help. And everyone's like, aren't you from that liar place? And they're like, yeah, we don't trust you. So the city's been isolated and dehydrated for hundreds of years. And the story picks up with this little boy named Tutu, who is about to turn 13, about to lose his tongue, when his mother passes out from dehydration. She's on death's doorstep. And he's thinking, sure, I can wait a couple days and lose my tongue and get enough water to revive her. Or I can go outside the city walls into this endless, terrifying, magical, brutal desert with roaming killers from the Ajungo Empire and giant beasts and all kinds of unknown things. And I can find water, not just for her, but for the entire city and end this cycle altogether. That's where the story kicks off.
Now we're talking. Yeah, no, that sounds really cool. Excellent. Thanks. Elevator pitch.
Try
so it. That's book one. We mentioned that book two, The Truth of the Aleke, is coming out on March 5th. Mm-hmm. But book two is nothing without book one. So check out The Lies of the Ajungo. And I assume it's available everywhere. Fine books.
Available everywhere, so. Yeah. Support your local bookstores, but it's available everywhere.
Sure. Yeah. All right. Well, perfect. Moses, Ose Utome. Utome.
You got it.
Thank you so much for joining me and for picking Jade City and getting me to finally read it. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. It's rare that you get a geek out like this. This format is awesome. You guys are doing cool stuff here.
I appreciate it. All right. Well, and for everybody else, like I said earlier, links to all this stuff will be in the description. Links to Moses' website and his books, links to our website and Patreon and all that stuff. So make sure you check out the show notes. Thank you all for listening, and I will see you next time.